You're listening to the On-Call Nightmares podcast, and every week I present conversations with technologists who've spent time on call. This week, I talked to Molly Struve of Kenna Security. It was a really good conversation. It was right after I got back from Hawaii. She was a really, really nice person to talk to about how she got into tech, which is yet another person with not a common path. And it's always great to hear about the different ways people have found their way into technology. We've got the 4th of July holiday coming up, so I'm going to be presenting this episode a day early. Hope you enjoy it. If you'd like to be on future episodes, let me know. You can do it real easy. Send an email to oncallnightmares@gmail.com or send me a tweet. It's @oncallnightmare or @jdestro. So let's get into the conversation with Molly right now. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to On Call Nightmares. And every week, except for last week because I was on vacation, I go out of my way to find you technologists who have spent some time on call and have some conversations with them. Today, I am lucky enough to have met Molly Struve while spending time on Twitter asking for during, I believe it was Dev.2, they were asking about Dev Discuss, and I wanted to hear about people who saw success with their on-call. And Molly reached out. Molly is a lead site reliability engineer at Kenna Security, and she joined Kenna in 2015 and has done some really challenging things with Kenna's code base, implementing Elasticsearch, sharding MySQL, and creating a better infrastructure that helped Kenna grow faster. You can find Molly Struve on Twitter at Molly_Struve. Hi, Molly. I hope that was enough.
Yeah, sounds good. How's it going?
Not bad. So I hear you like to ride and jump show horses too.
Yeah. So that's kind of a second passion of mine. I know it's kind of unique. You get a lot of people in tech who just do tech like all the time. And I'm kind of one of those, I don't quite do it all the time. I also ride horses.
Yeah, you also got a really interesting start, and we'll talk more about what you've done in tech, but I want to get started with what I found was really cool, which you started in aerospace?
Yeah. So I literally went to school, and I started out in software engineering. I took the intro class, and while taking that class, the guy who lived next door to me was taking the aerospace class, and he kept running over every day, "Hey, guess what we get to do? We get to build a rocket. We get to build a parachute." And I literally thought, that sounds a lot more fun than banging on a keyboard. And so I switched classes, took the intro to aerospace class. Rest was history.
And so you spent some time in the aerospace industry, but then decided to make your way into writing code full time, it seems. I just looked at some of your early portions of your career that you've got published. And then you went on, you became kind of a full-time software developer and then eventually an engineer. You want to talk about kind of like what led you into your first on-call role? Kind of like how you got started as, say, a non-traditional, with a little bit of a traditional in there, I suppose,
too. Yeah. So obviously, when you're an engineer, kind of everyone who studies engineering has that same similar, you get that base, problem-solving strategy skill set when you're in college. So after graduating, I, did a little bit of options trading because that was kind of a family business. And then really after 2 years, I just wanted to go back to building things. I wanted to go back to my engineering roots. And so I quit my job. I spent 3 months teaching myself web development. So I had some, basic Java programming experience, but never web development. So taught myself that and then got a internship at a small startup company.
Was there a framework that you felt like got you into that web development world that said, "Oh yeah, this makes sense. I'm going to do this."
So at the time, literally I was just kind of looking at Hacker News and whatnot. And I saw Ruby on Rails. And I saw that a lot of the big companies were using Ruby on Rails. So I was like, hey, that's what I'm going to learn.
It's a very common way I felt people, found their way into software development, it appears to be, is that that you find a framework that really makes you feel comfortable. And I've also found this around,
you know, distributed services engineering, like using Chef. Like, if you understand enough Ruby, you look at it and you're like, this makes sense to me. I can build with this. And I felt Rails did that.
Exactly. And Ruby itself is just such a nice language to read and write.
Sure. So you spent some time working in this, like, Rails shop after learning on, like, how to become a Ruby on Rails engineer. Where does it go from there?
Yeah, so I worked at the startup. It was a little tiny coupon startup. It was called Aisle 50. And after about 2 years, we got acquired by Groupon.
Okay.
So that was kind of, you know, interesting going through that whole process. Now, when we joined Groupon, they kind of split our team up and put us on other projects. And sure. I lasted about 6 months at Groupon. I just didn't like the big company feel. I wanted to go back to that small startup. And so that's when I started looking, and I found Kenna, which at the time was, you know, about 30 people. And it kind of fit the mold of what I was looking for. So, you know, I started with them, and that was 4 years ago at this point. And the rest has been history. I've been there ever since, and it's been awesome.
That's great to hear. So let's get start a little about your on-call history. Which one of those careers would you say you were, like, the first time you either were officially or unofficially on call?
Yeah, no, it was right from the beginning. So when I joined that first little startup, Aisle 50, there was 4 developers. And because the company was so small, it wasn't so much of an on-call shift as everyone took a customer service shift. And so during that week that you were on customer service duty, you not only were responsible for, you know, ensuring the app was up, but then you also were answering a lot of, you know, customer emails when someone was like, oh, this button doesn't work, et cetera, et cetera. You were the one dealing with that. So honestly, it was right from the start. I was just thrown right in there and, you know, kind of learned the ways of, you know, responding to incidences.
And were your incident responses working directly with the customer, or were you working with, like, some sort of middle person, like sales or someone like that?
Right at Aisle 50, it was right with the customer.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. So you're doing real time, like, you know, troubleshooting of issues alongside, you know, keeping people, when they feel like there's something wrong with your product impacting their business, calming them down as well.
Exactly. You know, for a lot of these people, it was, you know, they were trying to use our app to save themselves money. And so if it broke and they weren't able to get those discounts that they were hoping, I mean, for some of them, they're living paycheck to paycheck, and that's super important. So you've got to kind of be there not only to, you know, fix the bug, but you also have to be, you know, manage the user side of the situation as well. Sure. So that was is very eye-opening.
So then you, you spend some time there, and then when you go over to the Groupon, does Groupon formalize, or when Groupon acquires, do they formalize your on-call process at all? Or do they kind of leave things as is? And, you know, by the time you left, you don't know really how that changed.
Yeah. So when they acquired us, they really acquired us a lot for the talent and some of our, some of the software we had built and the knowledge that the engineers had. And so what they did is they took us and they put us on another team that they had building an app. And so that team had a super informal on-call rotation. And I'm going to be honest, I was only there for about 6 months and never learned enough about that application for them to put us in that on-call rotation. So I kind of had like a 6 month break right there where it was just kind of building and not being on call.
So then you think that there was kind of like, I like to call it like the acquisition education gap, maybe.
You know,
and it happens a lot with organizations that, you know, they bring their technical debt along with them, and that technical debt doesn't sometimes respect the other side that's being acquired and saying, well, you know, we understand you have this kind of mishmash process of doing this, and it's hard to teach us it, but you have to teach us it.
Exactly. And it didn't help. They had brought us in to rewrite a PHP app in Ruby and Rails. And so the on-call was supporting the PHP app. Well, you got Ruby and Rails developers. We're just like, we don't even know where to start if the PHP app breaks.
So you move forward a little and you're eventually move on and you go over to Kenna. And Kenna, are you part now of a more formalized operations and on-call team, if you will?
Oh, yeah, 100%. So as soon as I joined Kenna, early on, there wasn't a very formal process, but it probably was about 6 months into starting, we actually made an on-call rotation. So, you know, we went into pager duty, we got the on-call set up, so someone's getting buzzed when things go down. And that was really kind of my first foray into a very formal on-call rotation with all the on-call tools that a lot of people are very familiar with.
Sure. So let's get into the bulk of the podcast, the big thing. And before we do that, because now I kind of know where you are and how you got there, and I appreciate that. And I'm sure that there's a lot more to you than the short, you know, career story. And of course, I've heard about the horses, which is already – intrigue me because you know I got a friend that they got married only a couple years ago. She his wife loves to ride the show horses. You know, she does the whole helmet and the outfit, and I'm always just like, how did you marry someone that knows how to do something so proper and amazing looking? And just like the horses are just an interesting animal as a dog person myself. Yep. So they just – thank you for having that little bit in the bio that you share with me, because I always like to hear a little bit more about the person. But before we get into a nightmare or nightmares, whichever you want to share with us today, I'm going to go over what I do at every episode. Is I'm going to just go over the rules of the podcast, and they're pretty simple. And I share them every time. One, do not incriminate yourself because, you know, we don't want you to.
Good advice.
Yeah, I mean, hey, I don't know what could happen from that. And let's not incriminate others because, as we've learned in DevOps, we should be blameless about our retrospectives. Mm-hmm. And help us learn, because that's what this podcast is. It's one big retrospective. And everyone that's been on this podcast has helped us learn something from it. So what I'd really like to do is hand you the microphone for a little bit and just let you tell us about a story or a situation that, you know, you went through.
Yeah, definitely. So I think one of the, you know, I kind of want to talk about what spurred the turning point in from us kind of switching from the old on-call rotation to the new on-call rotation, which I kind of is what, you know, I mentioned on Twitter. And also what I would like to write a blog post about. So probably about a year ago, we kind of had grown at that point a lot. So when I originally started, we were about 7 engineers. And about a year ago, we, you know, we're at like 15 to 20 now. So a lot more. And despite all the growth, we still had that single on-call rotation. So engineers going on-call once every few months, which that sounds like heaven to people. That's great. I hardly ever have to be on call. Sure. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite work out that way, because you're not on call a lot. You're not getting those reps that you need. And so because of this, we went through a few months where we had our SRE team, our site reliability team, that had kind of broken off from the main devs. Mm-hmm. And then we still had all the devs going in their on-call rotation. Well, for a couple of months, we had incidences happen. You know, quite a few of them actually ended up happening on the weekend. I'd be sitting in the middle of lunch, and all of a sudden, I'd get a Slack message. Hey, you know, these queues are backed up. Or, hey, you know, this you know, service is returning 503s. You know, what's wrong? And so I'm kind of one of those people. I am always willing to jump on help. So I just grabbed the laptop, kind of log in, see what's going on, explain to the person who's actually on call, hey, you know, this is what's going on. Here's how I would fix this and address this. And usually, you know, a few hours later, depending on how big the incident was, you know, kind of send them on their way. Well, despite me being, you know, happy to help, it ended up taking a toll on me and the rest of the SRE team, because we were kind of on call 24/7 just because of our general domain knowledge.
And then you're just dealing in toil instead of actually fixing anything. And this is the common conversation that happens on this podcast a lot, is that toil ends up being so visible when a team formalizes things.
Yep. Yeah. So that's kind of the moment when we're like, we kind of stepped back and said, okay, this is not working. And on top of it, so you got your SREs, we're burned out. We're not happy with the situation. On the flip side, you got the devs, and they're also not happy, because when they go on call, it's very stressful for them, because one, they're not on call a lot, so they're not very practiced. And when a situation arises, they don't know how to deal with it.
Were your incidents fairly repetitive? Did you have incidents that were going on and tended to be the same? Were there a lot of things that were kind of, you know, always different problems? Like, what was the general, like, difference in the problems that people would have to jump onto that was eventually just burning out your team? Was it, you know, the same, or was it new stuff every time?
So they all kind of had the same general category. They all were related to growth. So every time we would get more data, more clients, we would kind of hit a breaking point somewhere in our stack. Sometimes it was background jobs. We'd throw a bunch of data at background jobs. We get workers that weren't fast enough. They'd get backed up.
Sure.
Sometimes we'd be trying to hit the database with a ton of workers, more than normal. And then the database would be slowing down. So they're all related to us trying to scale, but they kind of showed up through all kind of different areas in the stack.
So as you're scaling, you're finding your pain points, and you're doing that whole almost testing in production, as everyone likes to say.
Exactly.
And you're seeing where. So how did this start impacting individuals? Let's get on that. Like, you know, how many people were working on these same constant problems around growth?
Yeah. So, like I said, the biggest problem was that the SREs were getting burned out, because we would be pulled into every single one of these problems every time they arose. And the reason we were pulled in is because you got devs that are not on call a lot, so they're not very familiar with all the systems. They're not very familiar with the alerts. So when an alert goes off, you know, we tried to write up some documentation, but still they were not able to handle the alerts themselves. So they're kind of helpless. So they're reaching out to us, and we're always having to jump on. So it basically ends up that the SRE team is just trying to fix and support all these on-call issues. And so we don't have time to actually do our own projects and work on our own things to actually improve the infrastructure. And so in the end, it was really, no one was happy. It was kind of just, you know, not great.
Developers are bummed out because they don't know why their code isn't working.
Yep.
And the SREs are burned out because they're dealing with bummed out developers while still trying to make heads or tails of the situation. And you make something very well known, which is there's a lack of ownership in the incident long term. When it takes three different teams to bounce it back and forth just to get through that individual, and not knowing where the documentation lives afterwards. Yep. Who's responsible for the postmortem on the issue? So yeah, I can see how that's going to start really burning people down, and it's going to be difficult. So how does your team start really overcoming this? Like, you know, you're always on call and you're always dealing with the same problems. How do you basically dig yourself out?
So, you know, immediately the SRE team said, okay, this can't continue. We're burned out. We're not happy. We're working all the time and supporting everything. So, you know, we took a hard look at our dev teams. At this point, we have three different dev teams. Now, a lot of times that might seem okay. That's pretty simple. You got three dev teams, like maybe you do three on-call rotations. Well, a kind of unique thing is we still have one monolithic application. So all three dev teams work kind of across the entire app. Some have certain pieces they work with, but for the most part, everyone's kind of working on the same app. So there's no immediate, like, okay, good way to split it up. But despite that, we decide, okay, we need to get people on call more often. They need more reps. That's the only way we're going to get them more comfortable. So we took on the task of splitting up the rotation by team. So every dev team, which contains six or seven devs, now have their own rotation. And one of the you know, big hurdles we had to overcome was, okay, so we have these three dev teams with three rotations. Now, what do they own? How do we take this monolithic application and split it up so each of these dev teams own a chunk of it? And then on top of that, how do you...
You're ad hoc microservicing your support, if you will.
Exactly. We're microservicing on call, in a sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and to do this, it took, you know, multiple meetings between me, our SRE team, and the dev managers to figure out where to draw the lines. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we drew them in a couple different ways. We broke up background workers. So, you know, we have a fleet of 50 background workers. We took mm-hmm. them and we kind of put them in categories and we gave categories to each team. Then we took alerts that we had. So we use Datadog for alerting and we have probably 30 alerts in there that trigger from all different things. Some, you know, trigger if a database is under load, some trigger if a worker is backed up. And we took those alerts, split those up between the teams. Sure. So then you have left the application itself. Okay, how do you, you know, it's a Rails application. So, you know, how do you deal with, okay, who owns the user views? Who owns the account settings? You know, how does that work? And we kind of split it up by controller. We said, okay, users controller, that's going to team one. You know, assets or, you know, another controller, reports controller, that's going to go to team two. And we split it up that way. So basically those three ways are how we split it up. And then we document the crap out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And we use Jira and Confluence. So we just basically document everything in there. The teams were made well aware of each piece of ownership. And here's where it really kind of started to click. So as soon as we split everything up, the SRE team sat down with each team and we went into depth explaining exactly what they owned. And so for the mm-hmm. first time, you actually saw developers understanding what they were supporting and what they were going to actually have to, you know, handle. They were learning the in-depth nuances of, for example, the Redis team. We were showing them everything they need to know about Redis, how to talk to Redis, how to debug it. And
it's that's more than just where you're putting things. There's a portion of Redis that you need to understand, that it's a living, breathing portion of your stack. It's not just a thing that you're dumping data in and out of.
Exactly. And that's kind of what the mindset was before, is they were writing code. It would interact with Redis, but then they'd mm-hmm. just deploy it and they'd forget it. Now,
yeah, I mean, it's a common thing that happens a lot of times, I think, with software development, is that we look at these things that are almost just like empty buckets. You know, literally yep. the S3 bucket is almost like the best way to think about it. It's like they're empty buckets when we put things in there and we don't recognize how that will scale long term, like when you need to start querying an S3 bucket that you've been just dumping stuff
in there. Yeah, you don't know what's in there.
Yeah, so you start giving them greater education on their stacks, it sounds like. And that improves communication overall, correct?
Exactly. So, you know, their understanding of their systems and our system in general, the general domain knowledge skyrocketed at that point on the dev team about how our back-end systems work. Because then, you know, we split up things like alerts. So the SRE team was kind of in charge of building out our alerting and monitoring system. That was a big project we had. And mm-hmm. when we handed those alerts over to a team, we said, okay, these are your alerts. They were invested in those alerts. And they took them, they made them way better than we could have ever thought they could be. So our alerting infrastructure has improved immensely because of it, because these teams now are, you know, they're very focused on their own alerts and they want them to be actionable and they want to catch these things earlier in the process. And it's, sure. the mind shift has been quite, you know, quite extraordinary and a lot of fun to watch.
People tend to care more about their alerts when they're on the other side of them.
Yes.
And that's the thing that I've found is true. And the more I hear people talking about, well, you know, your developer should be on call, the more you start recognizing that
as you improve alerts, people stop saying, yeah, I don't care if I'm on call, because they only get really alerted under serious, like, consequent, like, incidents. Like, it's not giving people random pages because memory utilization was high. And I've had this conversation many times where you stop being so, you stop walking over with what you find to be the template, and you become much more prescriptive on what a situation requires. That helps teams a lot, because then, like I said, people become more attached because they know what the alert is going to be. They know why it's going to be triggered, and they know the consequences of what's going to happen if it does get triggered. Maybe there's not going to be background jobs that are going to be processed. Maybe something's not happening. So it sounds like what you've tried to do is create a sense of responsibility within your own developers. And I believe that it was, someone on the show once used the term, the conscientious developer is one of the best on-call resources you can have. And I guess by making these conscientious developers part of your on-call resource, part of the process, you've really set yourself, your company up and your teams up for success.
Yeah, and it's, like I said, their ability to take stuff and then improve it beyond what even we set up as an SRE team has been pretty remarkable. And, they've made the on-call system even better. And sure, there's times when, say, a Redis alarm goes off. Mm-hmm. The team kind of digs in. It might be related to work another team did, but that's okay, because the team who the alert went to, they know very quickly how to figure out what that alert came from. And so their ability to react extremely fast is great. And so then they can go to the team that might have deployed the code that caused it and say, hey, this is what we're seeing. This is how we think you should, deal with it. Can you fix this? And so, one, the response time is a lot faster now. And then two, the teams are, it forces them to all communicate. And, on the flip side, you have three people on call at a time. So no one ever feels alone. That was one of the biggest, kind of pain points for the developers was when they were on call, they felt very alone, and like they didn't know who to go to. And so they'd always go.
Knowing who to escalate to in those moments is very, very important.
Exactly. And so now there's three of them. And so they're really never alone. They can easily, if they don't know what's going on, they can reach out to one of the other two people that are on call and say, hey, I got this alert. I'm not quite sure about it. What have you guys been working on? What do you have any thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? It sounds like that team has really come together, tightened up, and really found ways to, provide better reliability. I mean, that's what an SRE team is there for.
Yeah.
Improve reliability. So if someone is listening to our interview right now and you could give them some advice on being on call, what would you give them?
Yeah. So I'd say first and foremost, when those alarm bells start going off, it is it's super easy to kind of panic, especially, someone who has her phone set, so if PagerDuty goes off, it sounds like a siren. it can be jarring. Don't panic. One of the kind of things that our VP of engineering once said to us in a post-mortem that we had, we had just had an incident. Everyone was kind of down in the dumps about it. We felt kind of bad. And he kind of looked at all of us and he said, you know what, guys? We're not saving lives here. If someone can't view their data for 20 minutes, they're going to live. And it kind of puts it into perspective for you. For many of us, not all of us, but many of us, we're not saving lives. If a website goes down, it's going to be okay. Just focus on getting it back up as quickly as you can. And then after that, try to figure out what went wrong. But try to remember, we're not usually talking life or death here. So there's no reason to panic. There's no reason to, freak out about it. Just do what you've been taught to do and problem solve the situation.
Very cool. So let's talk a little bit more about what you're up to nowadays, and we'll kind of wrap up our conversation. But tell me a little about what you're doing at Kenna Security and what Kenna Security is providing to customers.
Yeah, so Kenna Security, we help Fortune 500 companies manage their cybersecurity risk. So the average company has somewhere around 60,000 assets. You can think of an asset as basically anything with an IP address. So computer, server, even a printer. And in addition to 60,000 assets, the average company has 24 million vulnerabilities. So a vulnerability is basically any way you can hack an asset. Mm-hmm. Now, with all that data, it can be extremely difficult for companies to know what they need to focus on and fix first. And that's where Kenna comes in. So at Kenna, we take all this data, we run it through proprietary algorithms, and then those tell our clients what vulnerabilities pose the biggest risk to their infrastructure, so they know what they need to focus on and fix first. Basically, what we can do in seconds, you know, using our, you know, our back-end databases, used to take security teams of like 10 to 20 people weeks to do. They literally had these giant spreadsheets of all these vulnerabilities, and they had to go through them by hand and figure out which ones to fix. And so we take all of that out because it's all automated. And we say, hey, here are your top 100 vulnerabilities. You got to fix these first.
Very cool. Well, you know, Molly, was really great getting a conversation with you today. I really do appreciate it. I learned a lot more about how your team has really, I guess, become a lot more efficient, and it's really led to a better life for all of you, to be honest with you. Because once those, you know, random pages that don't have a lot of action, once they stop, you get to have a better existence overall. And I think that's one of the cool things about learning from this podcast, is how people take a bad situation, learn from it, and help improve everyone else that they're working with, and ultimately the user of their product, their software, you name it.
Definitely. And we've all been there. That's the thing, is we all have had these common experiences. And so it's nice to be able to share how we've kind of solved and worked through them.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Molly Struve. You've been a great guest, and people can follow you on Twitter at Molly_Struve, and that is spelled MOLLY_STRUVE. Was there anything else you'd like to sign off with?
Nope, this has been great. Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. Thanks so much for being part. So we'll wrap up. We'll finish the podcast, and hopefully I'll beg you all to be on the next episode, just like I did Molly. Thank you very much, Molly. We'll be right back. Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation, because I really did. Molly was really great to speak with. Once again, that was Molly Struve of Kenna Security. Feel free to reach out to her on Twitter, Molly_Struve. If you would like to reach out to me and be on this show, it's real easy. You can email oncallnightmares@gmail.com or reach out on Twitter @oncallnightmare or @jdestro. We'll see you next time.